You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and 106.7 FM in St. Paul. It's also streaming live on the web at www.kfai.org. I'm Lynette Rainey-Grandel.
And I'm Ian Graham-Leask. Today on Right on Radio, Bernice Kohler-Johnson joins us to talk about her book, The Shan, Refugees Without a Camp, an account of her experiences working with Shan refugees who've escaped genocide in Burma by fleeing to Thailand. More information about The Shan and her work can be found at www.bernicejohnson.com.
We've got this, plus your What's Happening calendar of literary events, so please stay tuned for Right on Radio.
In 2004, and again in 2005, I traveled to Burma to see the reality of the stories my students had told me. Despite obvious poverty, the threadbare clothing of residents, the oxen carts and the pickup trucks held together with wire, the cities had pleasant, peaceful facades, but large areas of the countries were off limits, and I knew from my students what was happening there. The homes of the poor were being burned, their possessions and rice fields confiscated. They were being shot or raped for the slightest infractions. Fear of the military was paralyzing. When I mentioned the name of Aung San Suu Kyi, I heard the whispered caution, cannot say her name, cannot say her name, or don't talk about her, spies might be listening. In some areas, the regime has been successful in repressing all knowledge of Suu Kyi. Most of my Shan students in Thailand didn't know who she was. Their hope lay with the Shan leaders and their ability to lead them out of destitution and despair. In 2005, 10 of the most prominent Shan leaders were arrested. Their prison sentences varied from 75 years to 106 years. In 2006, one of them died in prison.
And that was Bernice Kohler-Johnson, right? I can't handle the German spelling. Bernice Kohler-Johnson has lived and taught English in Spain, Indonesia, Ecuador, the Dominican Republic, Guatemala, and Thailand. Presently, she lives in Minnesota and Thailand. She speaks to church groups, school groups, and civic groups, talking about the plight of Shan refugees and raising money for projects her former students have initiated, such as teaching English, Shan and Thai languages to the Shan refugee children. These children have fled to Thailand with their parents, who live in constant fear of being deported and subjected to possible torture, imprisonment, and death. And her book is just newly out. It's called The Shan, Refugees Without a Camp. Welcome to Right on Radio, Bernice.
Thank you, Lynette.
So tell our listeners a little bit about your pathway getting involved in this, and then what is the history of the Shan? I think we don't know much about history in the United States, and so this is something we might be unfamiliar with.
Well, so far as my pathway is concerned, as you read, I had been teaching English as a foreign language in foreign countries during the winter months since 1993, started primarily as a way to escape winter. And
we can all relate to that.
Yeah, in 2001, I saw an ad to teach English to refugees from Burma who had fled to Thailand. And I was more interested in seeing Thailand than in the refugees, because that word was frightening to me. It connoted need, and a really deep need, emotional and financial. And I was a bit afraid of getting into that. But I fell in love. And so I have gone back. I will be making my 8th trip. Wow. To Thailand and to the refugees in this month, the 16th, I will be leaving. But your other question was, tell us about the Shan.
History, yes.
Yes. The Shan are the largest ethnic group in the country of Burma, second only to the Burmans themselves, and they live in the largest state. Their land is wealthy in jade, diamonds, rubies, teak, and two important rivers that the junta, the military junta, wants for hydropower. And so they dispossess them. They chase them off the land and burn their homes, confiscate their rice fields. And they flee to Thailand when they can. Some of them hide in the jungle and survive as best they can, but they have no doctors, no schools, no medical supplies.
What is their ethnic group then? They're the Shan, but certainly we had somebody on the show fairly recently talking to us about what's happening in the Eastern Congo, and it was very interesting to find out that ethnic groups or the tribes crossed borders. Now, who are the Shan? Are they Thai or what exactly?
They are like first cousins to the Thai.
Yeah. And do they have a separate language?
Yes, they do, but it's very similar.
So it's Thai.
It's the Shan language.
Okay.
It is different from the Thai language, but very similar. So
do they understand each other?
The Shan pick up Thai very easily.
Mm-hmm. So it's like Dutch and German?
They do go to school, though, perhaps. Yeah. Yes, Dutch and German.
Okay, That makes sense. And they're when they're going into Thailand, is that because they see the Thais as cousins or simply because it's the closest country to get into?
They flee wherever the closest place. Mm. And Shan State shares a border, east and north border with Thailand, but China actually is directly north on that part, and so many do flee to China too.
Mm.
But of course, I know the ones in Thailand.
Are there refugee camps in China?
I don't know if they're refugee camps per se. I don't think they are. I don't think they get international aid. The Shan have no refugee camps either because they are not considered refugees, though they meet the UN definition.
Why is that?
I think it's because of that close relationship. The Shan once occupied, or their kingdom, let's say, extended through Thailand, Laos, and part of Cambodia. And so when they first started coming into Thailand, they were accepted as I said, as cousins, first cousins, and well-treated. And some of those first Shan did now have permanent citizenship.
But then they came in greater numbers and overwhelmed Thailand. And I mean, you know, we're familiar with backlashes all over the place. Is it something like that?
Exactly.
Okay.
There are, I would say, at least 500,000 Shan in Thailand now.
Hmm.
And but also, as you said, Ian, is it because they see it's better there? It is that as well. The Shan refugees that I know have, most of them have huge pictures of the king and queen in Thailand in their little huts because they really do revere them, although they are also persecuted in Thailand often. There are long periods of peace and stability there, and it's so much better than Burma that they do revere.
Now, you're using the name Burma, but I think to let our listeners know connect it with other information they already know, Burma is also referred to as Myanmar, and so I mean, which has been in the news over the last few years. So if you could talk about that, and I think is it a year ago or less than a year ago where there were huge news stories about the murdering of the Buddhist priests that they were protesting this, and I think that maybe our listeners are not connecting this all together. So if you can explain that.
Yes. So far as the name is concerned, the military junta now in power took power in a 1962 military coup. So they are not a legal government. The U.S. government never recognized the renaming of the country to Myanmar. And if you hear President Obama or Hillary Clinton talk about the country, you will notice they say Burma. The ethnic groups don't accept the renaming because they say it is a name that is exclusive to the Burman ethnic group.
Mm, okay.
And what is that? See if you can differentiate for us the differences between all these groups. And when you can, see if you can give us a geographic picture of what is happening in this place.
The Burmans descended from Tibet about perhaps 4,000 years ago. The Shan descended from China, from Yunnan province, about 3,000 years ago into an area that was then called the Federated Shan States, and it was a country in itself, as the United States is a country in itself. And it remained such, with power fluctuating, actually, between the Burmans and the Shan until 1890, when the British colonized it and lumped it all together. Then when they got independence from Great Britain in 1947, they asked the Shan, there was a leader then by the name of Aung San, who was the great Burmese hero. He fought first with the Japanese to gain freedom from the British, and then as the Allies started winning World War II, he fought with them. His only goal was independence for Burma. And he went to the ethnic groups. Everybody trusted Aung San, including the ethnic groups. And he asked them to sign an agreement. He asked the Shan to sign what was then called a Pong Long Agreement, because it was signed in the town of Pong Long. And in that agreement, they agreed to be under Burmese rule for 10 years. 10 years. That was 1947. After which, they could ask for autonomy and it would be granted. It was never granted. They are still under Burmese rule, obviously.
And he was murdered before
it Aung could San go into was effect. Executed yes. before he could become president.
Yes, and he's the grandfather.
He is the father of Aung
father.
San Suu Kyi,
yes.
whose political party won. The military junta said they would have free and fair elections in 1989. Aung San Suu Kyi, Aung San's daughter, was back in the country then. She was working with students who were demonstrating against the military government and asking for democracy. So she was the leader of the National League of Democracy Party, which won the elections by 80-some percent. So what the military did was to imprison them. Aung San Suu Kyi was first in prison, insane prison, which is as insane as the name would imply, though it's spelled a bit differently. And since then, it's 20 years now since that election, and she has been under house arrest for 14. She just completed her 14th year of that 20 years that she has been under house arrest.
And she doesn't have to do that. She could easily leave and go to Europe or the United States, couldn't she?
Yes, she could. She could if she chose never to go back to Burma, never to be involved in politics again. They would let her leave.
And hasn't her house arrest just been extended because someone swam across a lake to have coffee with her or something?
You're right.
What's your opinion of all of that? Do you have an opinion on that?
I think at first I wondered if it was something the military had just set up as a way to get her back under house, keep her under house arrest, because her term was just expiring just after this happened, and that they'd keep her out of the way because they have again promised free and fair elections the first time since 1989. It's supposed to be next year, 2010. But as I read more about it in interviews with his wife, John Yetta was the man's name, I think he was sincerely deluded. He had a vision in which he saw terrorists attacking Suu Kyi. And if you can believe this, he made homemade flippers to swim across the lake. She lives on Inya Lake, to swim across the lake from his hotel to her home. This was not an easy feat because he's not a well person. He suffers from asthma, diabetes, and post-traumatic distress from his time in Vietnam, hence the vision, I would guess. But when he got there, there were two women who have chosen voluntary exile with Suu Kyi, who live with her. Suu Kyi did not see him, but they tried to turn him away, and he said he could not leave because he was exhausted, and he told them about all of his complaints. So they checked with her, with Aung San Suu Kyi, and she allowed him to stay. He stayed in her home. I don't think she ever met him, but he stayed there for two nights. And then as he was leaving, he was accosted by the military. But as it turned out, they had seen him coming in. So it probably was a pretext to get her back under house arrest, because you cannot have overnight guests without notifying the military government if you live in Burma.
So do you think that he's complicit in that?
No, that was my first thought, that he was complicit with that. But he's just a very deluded, sincere man who wanted to help.
They probably saw him coming and checked with their superiors, and the superior said, "Oh, great idea."
Yes.
Wow.
When we listen to other despots or despotic governments around the world, and I'm thinking particularly of the Iranian one at the moment, which has just kind of stolen an election, and what the nonsense that comes out of those folks, and I don't think I'm being biased and unreasonable when I say that. I hope I'm not. What are the levels of justification that the Burmese government bring to their lock hold on the people?
To keep control over the country, to keep, it's hilarious, really, to keep peace in the country. Well, the way they keep peace is, of course, by exterminating the ethnic groups or making them powerless at the best. The very best, they make them powerless. They have a new scheme now where they are asking the ethnic groups to be border guards in their own country under Burmese military men. And they are, in other words, they would be guarding the border with Thailand. So they would try, it would be their responsibility to keep their brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles from escaping to a better life.
So these would be Shan border guards.
Yes.
Trying to stop the Shan coming through.
Yes, and it's other ethnic groups as well. The Kachin, the Karen, I guess they call it.
There's a lot of, just to give our listeners a sense of Burma, the ethnic groups are quite distinct, aren't they, in many ways?
Yes, they are. I think the greatest distinction between the Karen and the Shan is primarily religion, because for some reason more Christian missionaries went into that part of the country, into the Karen part of the country. And they also have refugee camps in Thailand. So they can, because they have been living in refugee camps, they can sometimes get repatriated. We have a number of Karen in St. Paul. But the Shan, because they don't go into refugee camps, are not. They're stuck.
And both countries, you know, obviously share a very long border, don't they?
Yes.
All the way down to Tamil. I don't know how many miles, kilometers that is. Do you happen to know?
I don't know. I know that. I've heard both countries, both Burma and Thailand, I have heard of both of them that they are about the size of Texas.
But quite mixed up. And these are, and like we were saying before out in the lobby, absolutely heartbreaking, beautiful countries.
Yes.
And the whole region is absolutely gorgeous there. But you were mentioned, your assessment really was that culturally, and I suppose I don't think you said culturally, technologically is what I meant. Burma's about 300 years behind everybody. Is that what you said?
I would say about 150 years or 100 years behind our culture. In the smaller towns, well, even in Mandalay and some of the bigger towns, there are oxen carts for transportation, the pickup trucks that they use to cart people from place to place are just so overloaded and held together with wire because they're ancient.
Mm-hmm. In both countries, there's quite a lot of mixture between the Thai and the Roman Catholics. Are the Kerala that you're talking about, are they Catholic or is that Protestant?
No, I don't know of much Catholicism in Burma. It's Protestant.
Oh, it is Protestant.
Yes.
And was that from the British establishment there?
I'm not sure. I do know in Shan State I've read a number of books by a missionary doctor, Dr. Gordon Seagrave, and he was Baptist. So I think I don't know exactly, but there were American missionaries there before the junta, the military junta, chased all missionaries out.
So it's mostly Buddhist then, and then some Hindu?
It is.
There's Hindu there too, a lot?
If there's Hindu, I haven't heard about it. It is probably at least 90% Buddhist or higher.
Oh, okay.
I want to talk a little bit more about the British influence. My impression is that was not much missionary work. It was military. And you mentioned in your book that this is where George Orwell was stationed.
Burmese Days. Wonderful
book. Yes. Do you want to talk a little bit? Is that where the story of shooting an elephant comes from?
I think that was set in India. I'm not sure, but Burma was then, when Orwell was there, he was stationed there, but it was then part of their greater Indian Empire. Mm-hmm. So I think shooting an elephant, I believe, was placed in India, but I'm not sure. It could have been in Burma. If there are elephants left in Burma, there are few.
You are listening to Bernice Kaler Johnson. Her book is called The Shan, Refugees Without a Camp. Bernice, do you have another portion of it that you would like to read for us?
Yes, I'll read from the first chapter about my first day at the school teaching Shan refugees. Good morning, teacher. 25 golden-skinned students stood next to handmade tables with hands clasped prayerfully to their chests. Their greeting thrilled me, made my cheeks pink with tropical heat flush deeper. They stood at attention until I returned their greeting. We were in fertile northern Thailand, where flowers sprout from cracks in the pavement. But if I look through the open garage door behind the students, all I could see was a large asphalt expanse leading to another garage, a smaller one, like the one in which I taught English. A former family home, the school was open to youth from all ethnic groups of Shan State, Burma. But although there are more than 100 such groups scattered throughout the hills of Burma, the 25 students aged 14 to 29 were predominantly Shan, and their names confounded me. I arrived at school early each day and stood staring at the list of names, trying to fix them in my head. Most of the 18 men were Sai something. The 7 women were all Nang something, the NG at the end half swallowed. Impossible to remember. For weeks I didn't know which Nong or Sai I was talking with, and marveled that most men had variations of the same name, and the women had variations of another. Names I memorized in the morning eluded me in the afternoon when the converted garage became a sweat chamber. By the time tiny translucent lizards appeared and clung to the walls and ceilings, waiting to feast on mosquitoes that descended with dusk, I reverted to the generic you. Looking into a student's eyes, I would say, "What do you think? Do you know the answer? Have you finished your homework?" or I would point to this nung or that sigh, a gesture I later learned they considered impolite.
That is Bernice Kaler Johnson reading from her book, The Shan, Refugees Without a Camp. You got involved in all of this because you're an English as a second language teacher. Talk a little bit about how that works and why these students want to learn English.
They want to learn English because they believe, as George Soros does, who sponsored the first program that I went over on called the Burma Volunteer Program, that if they learn English, they can tell the world their story. And they firmly believe, these beautiful young people, that if we only know their story, we are sure to help them. Mm-hmm. They are convinced of that.
Mm. You're here in the studio. Our listeners can't see your face. You have a sad look on your face as you say that. You have some uncertainty about that.
The sadness is from that deep trust.
I'm sorry.
It comes from seeing that deep trust in them and knowing how very little we've been able to do. We have been able to do some really good things. Friends have helped me send many of my former students to advanced training, and they now have good jobs. And it's a joy to see them because their jobs all involve helping others. They are so concerned with helping others who have less than they, although they have very, very little.
Mm. Now, your students, or former students, I guess I could say, and they're getting jobs in Thailand. Is that where they want to stay and then help their other people? Or do they want to emigrate? Do they want to
They'd
move to other countries?
They'd love to emigrate.
Okay.
They cannot. They do not have Burmese passports, and they are not refugees. They are not legally designated as refugees. They meet the UN criteria. They are people without a country. Mm. They cannot go back to Burma, most of them, for fear of torture, imprisonment, and just general maltreatment at the hands of the military. And they're not wanted in Thailand because they have so many migrants, and that is what they are. They're what we call now. They're considered illegal migrants, as we have illegal migrants.
Well, yes. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, in the United States, this is a lot of the backlash against immigration, legal or non-legal, people coming to this country because it's not working wherever they came from. They feel like they have to come for survival. And, you know, a few seem to be easily absorbed. And then when a lot come, then there's anger. And I'm sure it's happening over there in even greater numbers.
Yes, and they get the worst possible jobs.
Yeah.
And make very little money. My former students are now teaching refugee children who are very young, between the ages of 5 and 16. And we started schools for them because their parents, many of them, cannot afford to send them to Thai schools. The time that we started, actually, they were not allowed in the Thai schools. Now they are. But their parents, for example, those who are sharecroppers, make at a maximum about $75 a month. Some months they get nothing because they are only paid when crops are sold.
Since we're talking about people on the lowest economic rungs and we're talking about Thailand, I think you need to talk to our listeners about the role of the sex trade in HIV/AIDS. I don't think most people realize how serious it is over there.
As many of the refugees from Burma do end up in the sex trade. If you like, I could read a bit from another chapter which does go into that.
Please
a bit.
Please do that. Yes, yes.
This is from a chapter called Charm Tong and the Girls. In the class of 25 students, there were only 7 girls. Now they have a higher ratio. It's about 50-50. But when the school first started, girls were afraid, and parents were afraid to send them. although many are sold into sex. Obviously not by the parents of these girls, but this is Charm Tongue and the girls. The day I arrived at the school for youth from Shan State, a girl dressed in blue jeans and a t-shirt greeted me with a hug. It was the founder and director, Charm Tongue, a girl with an amazing history. Charm Tongue was 6 years old when the Civil War raging in Shan State persuaded her parents to send her to safety in Thailand. They placed her in a hand-woven basket attached to a horse's back and brought her to an orphanage inside the Thai border, within earshot of gunfire that erupted from clashes between the Burmese military and the Shan ethnic group. The orphanage would be her home for the next 11 years. At night, Charm Tongue lay in a bed of rough-hewn lumber and cried herself to sleep with fear and loneliness. During the day, she studied the Thai and Shan languages and became proficient in Chinese and English, so proficient that at the age of 17, she was sent to the United Nations to testify about human rights abuses against the Shan. "I was very nervous, but I have to do it," she said. No ordinary girl, Charm Tongue. I noticed that the girls in the class, some of them were very fearful, and at the time I didn't know why till I read and learned more about them. Migrating with Hope, a compilation of statistics and anecdotes about Burmese refugees in Thailand, quotes a woman who said Burmese soldiers would come to their village at night and rape the women. Many women were caught and given to senior officers. After the officers raped the women, they'd be given to the other men. Those women who are too ashamed will move to another area or flee to Thailand to be sex workers. A few years after Migrating with Hope was published, Charm Tongue's women's group published License to Rape, which detailed sexual violations of Shan women by the Burmese military, including the 2001 rape of a girl whose arms and legs had been tied spread-eagled to a bed. Her parents came home from the rice fields and found her there, bloody and weeping. She was 5 years old.
You're listening to Bernice Kaler Johnson. She's talking about her book, reading from her book, The Shan Refugees Without a Camp. I understand that you traveled in Burma a bit.
Yes, I traveled there in 2004 and again in 2005.
Do you want to talk about that?
Yes, I can. I'll read you a bit from the end of the history. Or did I read this, the 2004 and again in 2005?
I don't think so.
I traveled to Burma to see the reality of the stories my students had told me. Despite obvious poverty, the threadbare clothing of residents, the oxen carts and the pickup trucks held together with wire, the cities had pleasant, peaceful facades. But large areas of the country were off limits, and I knew from my students what was happening there. The homes of the poor were being burned, their possessions and rice fields confiscated. They were being shot or raped for the slightest infractions. Fear of the military was paralyzing. When I mentioned the name of Aung San Suu Kyi, I heard the whispered caution. I think I did read this,
You said that part.
Yes.
Okay.
So I'm going to read from another part where I am actually traveling to Shan State, my first trip into Burma. December 3rd, 2004. I struggle out of my lady-sized backpack, that's what the fellow who sold it to me called it, and stash it next to the big strong guy models on the floor of Burma's government tourist office in Tachilek, across the Sai River from Thailand. The place is crowded with Western tourists. Most are European men in their 30s or 40s with muscular legs and broad shoulders, and with more than enough money to spend. Cameras dangle around their necks, and they wear expensive travel pants, the kind that zip off above the knee and convert to shorts. I look up at them, they look back, polite, dismissive glances. And although I'm 30 to 40 years older than most of these men, I feel the way I did in first grade, the smallest, youngest kid in the one-room school, powerless, with only good behavior to protect me. Carlene Herman was the only other girl. The rest were big, strong boys, husky like the travelers in this room. Looking at the young men who surround me, I wonder if I'm out of my mind to be traveling alone in Burma. This past year, I tore the medial meniscus in my left knee. At the same time, my back started aching, a deteriorated disc in the lower spine, the doctor said, the result of lugging too many heavy backpacks across too many countries for too many years. I could have stayed home, safe in the cocoon of my Minneapolis condo, but that's not the kind of life I want. I will not give up my lust for travel before I have to, will not settle into the mediocrity of coffee circles where caffeine highs encourage complaints about why we older people cannot do what we used to do. And my Shan refugee students have urged me to come here. They have urged me to visit Shan State since I met them in Thailand in 2002. It's safe for you, teacher, they said. Safe for me. A lucky accident of birth. But I'm nervous. In 2001, a French man who worked in a Thailand refugee camp rode his motorcycle across the Maysot border into Burma and was never seen again. An American woman who visited Aung San Suu Kyi when visits were still allowed was pushed into traffic afterwards, presumably by a military intelligence man. And a few months ago, an 81-year-old American man who protested in front of government offices in Rangoon was beaten and imprisoned before being sent back to the U.S. Every week, Burmese who have escaped to Thailand report new outrages committed by the Burmese government. Their vehicle is the Irrawaddy News, a Thai publication I get online. In Burma, opposition leaders and journalists who publish articles derogatory to the regime are imprisoned for years. That knowledge may be the reason most backpackers travel in twos. And here I am, alone, and I have a secret to keep. The government would not look kindly upon my involvement with Shan refugees in Thailand. My stomach is fluttery with excitement, anticipation, and fear.
Let's get our tickets now and go. That's fantastic. Well done. Really
yes.
Good writing.
We're almost out of time. Bernice, I understand that you have a foundation where you are looking for people to help sponsor your former students who are teaching. And how do they find out about that?
We have a website. It's www.shanrefugeeschools.org. Okay. My website has a connection to it, okay. And that is just bernicejohnson.com.
Okay, so go to your website, and then they can find that one. There's a link on our webpage to your website. So thanks so much for being on Right on Radio.
Yes, thank you very much. That was